I'm glad to have finally obtained the video. It reveals clearly what witnesses had told us had happened that day.
A surveillance video shows questionable conduct by a former Bethel police officer. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 2nd. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, the Senate Finance Committee cuts deeper into education funding a day after parents and students rallied in Anchorage.
Mostly, I'm just really disappointed in where the legislature is right now with its stance towards education funding.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying dealers throughout Alaska with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser water heaters for more than 28 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com. Join Alaska Public Media and participate in our statewide live online social screening and chat about the film The Home Stretch, Friday, April 17th from 12 to 1 p.m. Be part of the conversation about homeless teens in our communities. More at alaskapublic.org.
After nearly 7 hours of delay, the Senate Finance Committee has moved in operating budgets with hundreds of millions in cuts. This afternoon, the committee passed an amendment to cut education funding by nearly $100 million. The cuts go into the education funding formula, too, and amount to a $200 decrease in the base student allocation, the money the state uses to pay per pupil in the classroom. The committee also accepted an amendment to block Governor Bill Walker from unilaterally expanding Medicaid and an amendment to break the lease on the controversial Anchorage Legislative Information Office. Yesterday, the committee adopted language to freeze legislative pay. They also partially restored funding for public broadcasting. While the committee had previously zeroed out broadcasting money from its budget, they opted instead to cut the $5 million in funding by half. Committee members said all the cuts were needed in response to the state's $3.5 billion deficit. Surveillance video shows a former Bethel City police officer repeatedly slamming a man into the ground in the parking lot of a grocery store during an arrest last summer. The man eventually pleaded guilty to harassing the officer, but with the new evidence, an attorney is trying to bring the case back to court. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
The camera is far away, and the video has no sound, but it shows a uniformed police officer repeatedly picking up and dropping a man to the ground in the parking lot of the Alaska Commercial Company store. A few people pause to watch the event unfold. The officer picks the man up and slams him down at least 9 times. Nobody intervenes, including the other officer at the scene. According to the video and police documents, the incident took place on July 12, 2014, just after 9 a.m. A witness, Linda Green, a professor doing research in the area, reported what she saw to police and to the city of Bethel, but got no response. So she went to the media. From her home in Arizona, Green says she's relieved the video has come out to corroborate her reports.
I'm particularly glad because it hopefully will lead to some consequences for this kind of behavior.
The officer was later identified as Andrew Reed. KYUK requested a copy of the video from the Bethel Police Department on March 13th, about the same time that attorney Sean Brown, who represents the man being arrested, did.
I'm glad to have finally obtained the video for Mr. Gregory, and it reveals clearly what witnesses had told us had happened that day.
The video was recorded as surveillance for the Alaska Commercial Store. A police officer verbally denied KYUK's request for the video, but the department never sent a formal denial. Brown says the video should have been turned over to the Bethel District Attorney's Office.
I think it is upsetting and disturbing that even as of last week, I received written confirmation that the Bethel Police Department had never turned this video over to the district attorney's office so that the officer himself could be investigated by the district attorney's office, or so that charges could be considered against the officer for the actions he took against Mr. Gregory that day.
Derek Reimer is a spokesperson for the Northwest Company. When asked about the chain of events regarding the handling of the surveillance video, he said,
"The Northwest Company has cooperated with the local law enforcement as they requested, and we're hopeful that the issue can be resolved by them.
However, an email from an attorney for the company obtained by KYUK says the store manager provided the police chief with a hard drive containing the video. The email says when the manager requested the return of the hard drive from Bethel Police, the video had been deleted. The manager took the hard drive to someone in Bethel who was able to restore the video. It was then turned over to the attorney who shared it with KYUK. The police record differs from the video and witness accounts. A report says there was no call for police help, but Officer Reed on July 12th responded because he observed Gregory, a, quote, Indian male, at 9:18 a.m. as, quote, clearly intoxicated. The report says that Gregory made verbal threats to Reed and challenged him to a fight. The report says Reed was afraid that Gregory might be grabbing for a weapon. In an affidavit, Officer Reed says he, quote, kindly tried to assist Gregory into my cruiser for protective custody when he pulled away, end quote. The report says Reed then transported Gregory to the hospital, where he was medically cleared and says he didn't have any injuries other than a cut to his face. But a transcript from the initial court hearing quotes an Alaska State trooper saying Gregory was at the hospital because of a dislocated shoulder and a possible broken collarbone. Charges against Gregory of disorderly conduct and resisting arrest were dropped in exchange for him pleading guilty to harassing Reed. Brown, the attorney for Gregory, is pursuing a motion to withdraw the plea because of the new video evidence. The City of Bethel and the Bethel Police Department referred KYUK to their attorney, Bill Ingoldson, who said he couldn't comment because of ongoing personnel action involving Reed and possible litigation. Officer Reed was fired from his job at the Bethel Police Department last month. About the same time, a protective order was issued against him by a court in a domestic matter. He was hired in July 2012. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
KYUK contacted Andrew Reed for this story, but he declined a recorded interview. To see the surveillance video, go to alaskapublic.org. With two of Shell's rigs now crossing the Pacific in hopes of drilling in the Chukchi Sea this summer, officials and energy experts gathered at a forum in Washington this week to review the records and challenges, rather to review the rewards and challenges ahead for Arctic oil development. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Jan Mares, an energy policy advisor and former Homeland Security official, says the prize is within the industry's technical reach.
The U.S. oil potential offshore in our Arctic seems to be about 44 billion barrels of oil equivalents in less than 100 meters of water. That's actually pretty shallow by oil and gas development offshore.
Mares contributed to a report released last week by the National Petroleum Council that says the country must start developing the Arctic now so its oil will be available once shale oil production in the lower 48 declines. Mares says well control technology has improved greatly since the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Even if it fails, Mares says equipment would be available to stop the flow of oil.
The first one that would be the most significant in terms of reducing any possibility is what's called a subsea shutoff device. I'll show a picture of that in a minute. Second one would be a capping stack.
Former Deputy Interior Secretary David Hayes emphasized the challenges. With all the headlines about the receding ice in Alaska, Hayes says some don't realize the operating season in Alaska's far north is short, maybe 90 days.
And this is something that's frankly a little hard to digest, but we are looking at potentially drilling and potentially producing in a region that is mostly icebound most of the year.
Hayes says operators would have to stop drilling well before the end of the season.
So that if there is a spill, there is time to address it before the ice comes in, because there is no technology known to be able to clean up a spill effectively in icy waters.
And Hayes says there may be other interruptions.
You also have intrusion issues. When Shell had their program in the summer of 2012, they had to get off the Chukchi well because a huge iceberg was heading right for it, and they had to move off, lose a week or two, and then move back.
Willie Goodwin, a former mayor of Kotzebue, was the only Alaskan on the panel. Goodwin was unimpressed by talk about cleanup equipment and technology.
You know, for me as a hunter, you'll never convince me that you're going to clean it up.
Goodwin's main message at the forum, hosted by Washington think tank Resources for the Future, was that policymakers should have more meaningful consultation with local Inupiat. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
More than 50 fishermen have died after a Russian factory trawler sank in the Sea of Okhotsk on Wednesday. The Dolny Vostok was hauling in a load of pollock when it started to capsize. Within 15 minutes, the vessel was totally submerged. Good Samaritan vessels and emergency crews managed to save about half of the ship's crew. There were 132 fishermen on board at the time of the accident, almost twice as many as the vessel had when it left port in Russia. A provincial governor told Agence France-Presse that many of the crew members were foreign and not wearing life jackets or wetsuits when the ship sank. The Russian officials have started interviewing some of those surviving and the vessel's owner. According to a state-run news agency, they're investigating whether the 338-foot trawler was overloaded and whether it hit a patch of sea ice, damaging the hull. Russia's pollock industry has seen big changes in the last few years. The Sea of Okhotsk was named a sustainable fishery by the Marine Stewardship Council, putting it in the same category as pollock from the Bering Sea. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Western Alaska residents take steps to preserve their caribou herd.
It's the public stepping up and say, we care enough about this resource that we're willing to take a hit. I think that's really impressive.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University emphasizes teaching and research that engages the region's social, cultural, environmental, and geopolitical issues. The university's Early Honors Program attracts academically advanced high school students who complete their senior year credits while also earning college credits as full-time APU students. This message sponsored by APU.
Alaska has signed on to an amicus brief to the U.S. Supreme Court that says same-sex marriage bans should be upheld. 15 states, including 8 that currently allow same-sex marriages, signed the brief. It says forcing states to allow the marriages and recognize marriages from other states will cause, quote, incalculable damage to our civic life, end quote. The Attorney General's office issued a statement saying they are upholding the state's constitution. The court plans to make a final ruling on the issue later this year. Alaska lawmakers took a step towards clarifying who will regulate the marijuana industry. The House passed a bill today that would help define a municipality's role in regulating marijuana businesses, add marijuana clubs to the list of regulated marijuana businesses, and allow a municipality to develop some criminal penalties for marijuana. The bill would also enable established villages to prohibit marijuana businesses through an election or ordinance. It now goes to the Senate for consideration. Anchorage could be the last school district to get state reimbursement for its bonds before the program goes into a five-year hiatus. For the second time in 2 days, the Alaska House of Representatives voted to stop the program, which pays for up to 70% of municipal bonds meant for school construction. But on Thursday, a provision that would have allowed the bill to apply retroactively failed to meet the two-thirds threshold required for passage. Members of the House majority wanted the bill to go into effect January 1st, 2015. That's because Anchorage Municipal Ballot includes a $60 million bonding proposition. The majority leader, Cherise Millett, an Anchorage Republican, said on the floor that voters had been given sufficient warning before the April 7th election that their bond might not be covered by the state.
It does always say on our ballot on bond propositions that it is up to the legislature to decide if they can adequately fund a bond debt reimbursement.
But the Democratic minority leveraged their numbers to block the timing provision. Anchorage Democrat Garen Tarr disputed the argument that Anchorage voters would have enough notice.
It's not fair and it's not right with an election that's happening right now to pull the rug out from under that school district and give no other school district the time to plan.
If the governor approves the bill, it will go into effect 90 days after its signing, well after the Anchorage election. Community members gathered outside the Legislative Information Office in Anchorage yesterday evening to protest proposed cuts to education funding. Today, the Senate Finance Committee cut even deeper into the education budget, trimming $100 million from the base student allocation. KSKA's Ann Hillman has a report from yesterday's rally.
A group of about 60 people, ranging from grade schoolers to grandparents, stand in the corner chanting slogans.
Enough is enough!
Enough is enough!
Think about our education!
Two enthusiastic third graders from Winterbury join in. Hatcher Mestnes and Violet Bernoski say they're there to support their teacher.
She helps us learn and be able to go to college.
And education's really important. It's very important to my future, and I like that she's helping me with my ways.
West High 11th grader Charlie Lowell stands at the back of the crowd with a group of teenagers, surrounded by signs saying, "You've gone too far," and "Keep your promise."
Mostly, I'm just really disappointed in where the legislature is right now with its stance towards education funding. A lot of legislators that Great Alaska Schools and a lot of students really were banking on promised a lot to their constituents and the students and, you know, to education in general in this state. And right now what we're seeing is nothing of the sort that they promised.
The Senate is currently proposing to cut a variety of programs focused on early learning and literacy. That includes state funding for parents as teachers, which prepares first-time parents to help get their students ready for school. The Senate is also including cuts to the one-time grant funding promised in last year's HB 278. Great Alaska Schools Elise Galvin helped organize the protest.
We worked hard last year to get that bill 278. And now we know the governor made some suggestions that get cut down. And then the legislature took that and ran out of town with it. And frankly, we're not liking it.
The Senate plans to vote on the budget at the end of this week. They're trying to close a $3.5 billion budget gap. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Middle school and high school students all over the state are participating in the Alaska Measures Progress Test this week. This is the first year the tests are being completed online. KDLG's Matt Martin reports that cuts by the state legislature to broadband services could limit rural schools' ability to administer the tests.
Last year, the state legislature passed the Broadband Assistance Grant. The grant provided $5 million per year for rural schools for the next 3 years, in order to up their broadband capacities. The Southwest Region School District is composed of schools in 7 western Bristol Bay villages. Before the grant allowed them to up their bandwidth last year, the small schools in the district were at 2 megabytes per second and 4 megabytes per second in the larger schools.
Which is nothing. That hardly qualifies as household bandwidth in the lower 48, or even here these days.
Lester Parks is the technology coordinator for the Southwest Region School District. The goal of the district is to get the internet to 10 megabytes per second. He says the lack of high-speed broadband has not only restricted the use of teacher resources and student learning opportunities, but will also negatively impact the district's capacity to implement the new state-required AMP test. Parks says when the broadband is saturated, students aren't even able to load the login page for the test.
And we've also found that kids that were already logged in and testing when the bandwidth became maxed out were kicked out of the test and back to the login page, right in the middle of taking the test.
The Southwest schools are in the middle of testing right now, and Park says things are going much better.
We have had some small glitches, even with the broadband upgrade that we have in place now.
But if the legislature's cuts go into effect, the district will lose those upgrades. Park says the district will then be right back to having major testing issues again.
Unless we can come up with $171,000 somewhere. And we have no place for it to come from other than the broadband assistance for schools that we were told to count on for the next 3 years.
On top of losing the money, Park says the cuts will have meant that all the staff time and effort put into implementing the grant was a waste. On Tuesday, Parks testified before the Senate Finance Committee, saying the Broadband Assistance Grant is a sound investment in Alaskan schools, and requested the funding be reinstated. In Dillingham, I'm Matt Martin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
For the first time in 30 years, hunting restrictions are planned for the Northwest Arctic caribou. The Western Arctic and Teshekpuk herds lost half their members, rather their numbers, in the past decade. But this caribou crisis has spurred a unique collaboration where user groups across the state chose to share the burden of hunting reductions. KNOM's Jen Ruckle has more.
The Alaska Board of Game recently considered a proposal to actively manage Western Arctic and Teshekpuk caribou herds. And in a surprising turn, Northwest Alaska hunters pushed for greater restrictions, which were ultimately adopted by the board. Caribou biologist Jim Dow with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game says it was a highlight of his career.
That's the way resource management is supposed to work, not having government force things down the public's throat to conserve a resource. It's the public stepping up and saying, we care enough about this resource that we're willing to take a hit. I think that's really impressive.
And it is a serious hit. The Western Arctic herd in particular spans from Barrow south to the Yukon River, cutting from the Koyukuk River westward onto the Seward Peninsula. It's the state's largest herd, and caribou is a primary food source for over 40 villages that fall within its range. The new regulations will go into effect on July 1st and will impact resident and non-resident hunters by lowering bag limits and reducing the length of the hunting season. Charlie Lean is chair of Fish and Game's Northern Norton Sound Advisory Committee. He says it wasn't an easy decision.
It's a hard pill to swallow, but it's a matter of sharing the burden of conservation between all areas and being proactive before it reaches a real crisis.
That willingness to share the pain is what Dow says sets this scenario apart from the last caribou crash in the 70s.
That 1970s Western Arctic herd population crash may have been one of the most serious wildlife management debacles in the history of this state.
Dow says the state responded by completely closing caribou hunting for everyone, with little input from local users. Here's Jacob Ivanoff with the Southern Norton Sound Advisory Committee.
The Board of Game at that time had just said, you guys got to quit. It's pretty much basically what they said. They did not give them the opportunity to express their opinions as we were able to on this last meeting.
For the past 10 months, regional advisory committees have been assessing the population data and deciding how to react, ultimately opting to restrict their own opportunity for the good of the herd. The Western Arctic herd traverses a variety of state, federal, and private landholdings, and overlapping state and federal regulations often confuse hunters. Ken Adkison with the National Park Service in Nome says it would be ideal for the state and feds to pass similar regulations.
And especially as it reduces confusion in the hunter's mind, where they don't have to worry about whose land they're on and whether the harvest limit changes. I mean, the caribou don't really care much where those boundary lines go. And when you're migrating all the way from the North Slope, maybe almost to the Yukon River, you've got a lot of boundary lines to cross.
The question still on everyone's mind is what's causing the population decline. Data points in part to low calf survival rate, and users almost unanimously blame predation. But Dow says implementing an effective predator control program will be complicated by land ownership boundaries. And while state and local groups lean toward supporting intensive management, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Park Service remain opposed.
There are several guarantees in predator control. It's always controversial, it's always expensive, and it's never guaranteed. And all those things are going to be considered before the state does anything.
The adopted state regulations are likely just step one in addressing the caribou decline. Reporting in Nome, I'm Jen Ruckle.
Five Juno teens star in a play about the complexities of date rape. The show is called Hush, but as KTOO's Lisa Fu reports, the teens hope the audience does exactly the opposite.
And I could have said something, you know? I mean, I said no, but I could have said something else, or fought harder, or fought even more than, I don't know, something like that.
Brita Fagerstrom rehearses the role of Kim Tuesday night at Juno Douglas High School. Kim's been raped by her boyfriend and consequently deals with depression and getting her life back together. Fagerstrom hopes the message about consent is clear.
No means no. It shouldn't have to be a struggle. It shouldn't have to be some crazy, loud act. Even just saying no in a whisper, I mean, anything like that.
Damaris Oxman, who acts the roles of a parent and therapist, says the play explores how consent often gets muddled in a relationship.
Rob, Kim's boyfriend in the play, says we were fooling around and she may have said that she said no, but I knew what she really meant. And I feel like it kind of shows that some people in our culture really do think that somebody has a right to do whatever they want if they're already together. Like, that's a form of consent, but it's not.
Robert Newman plays Rob, a character confused about what he's done and isn't sure how to deal with the guilt or losing his friends. Newman says Rob isn't a monster.
It's any person. Any person who doesn't listen to their partner can fall into this role. And that's something we've really got to teach our generation.
For a group of actors who are used to performing in musicals and comedies, Hush was challenging and personal. Oxman says she had to sub in as Kim's best friend during a short performance last weekend.
It was very intense because I had to think about how would I react if this happened to my best friend or to me. And then it became very real.
Ashley Watt, who plays the best friend, says people sometimes don't realize they've been raped or are in denial.
We see things like this all the time where it's like, to some degree, something like this happens. And it's like, a lot of times people just ignore it. And that's not okay.
Director Michelle Amore says as a teacher and parent, she's heard and dealt with a lot of heartbreaking things having to do with partners not being respectful.
I just really hope that kids will come so they can begin to talk about these things and so that girls especially can realize that it is their right to give consent or not give consent, and that they need to stop letting boys have such power over their life.
Moore hopes the play makes people uncomfortable. Fagerstrom says it will make an impact.
This show is kind of jarring. It's putting it in your face. The reason it's called Hush is because it's a topic you don't talk about, but this show is about talking about it. It's about opening up a conversation with the community about it.
Fagerstrom says everyone needs to be part of the conversation, children, teenagers, adults, so it's out in the open. If not, she says, then sexual assault and date rape will continue to happen. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Bethel, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Matt Martin in Dillingham, Jen Ruckel in Nome, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Homestretch premieres on Alaska Public Media Monday, April 13th at 9 p.m. A film about three homeless teens braving Chicago winters, high school pressures, and life on the streets to build a brighter future. Following the film on Friday, April 17th from 12 to 1 p.m. will be a statewide online conversation and chat simultaneously engaging with panelists and community members about this film and homeless teens. Details at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.